Hi, everybody. I'm Donna Max, and I want to welcome you to our weekly Gospel Doctrine Enrichment Program. You know, it's really hard for me to believe that we've almost covered the entire Doctrine and Covenants. I am most grateful to the Lord for His Spirit. It certainly helped me with these lessons to a degree that I wouldn't have thought possible. Now, if you've taped these and are missing some of the shows, let me know. Call me at 377-5321. That's 377-5321. Well, if you'll take a moment to invite the Spirit to be with us today in our studies, I'll do the same, and I'll be right back. Welcome once again to our Study of the Scriptures. Last week we ended the program with the death of Joseph and Hiram Smith in Carthage. The history of the church says that Brigham Young and Orson Pratt were in Boston when they heard the news of the massacre. Kimball and White were in Salem, and Wilford Woodruff was in Portland, Maine, ready to step on board of a steamer for the Fox Islands when he read in the Boston Times newspaper of the deaths. Now, in past lessons, we've talked about how the non-members rejoiced throughout the country when they heard the news of the death of Joseph and Hiram. They didn't understand that Joseph Smith was a true prophet of God and was slain like other prophets throughout the various dispensations of time for their testimony. Well, premonitions of disaster were given to some of these general authorities. They suddenly felt a great sadness come over them, followed by a sense of grief. And then one by one, as the apostles heard the terrible news with heaviness of heart, they turned their faces back to Zion. It was now their job to sustain the next president of the church, and in this case it would be Brigham Young. An incredible man with an indomitable spirit. There's a light story told about Brigham as he journeyed back to Nauvoo after the death of Joseph. It seems that on his journey, he came to some Norwegians who were traveling with ox teams and heavily loaded wagons, one of which was stuck in the mud, blocking the road. The Norwegians were whipping the oxen and yelling at them in the Norwegian language, which seemed to frighten the oxen. Brigham got out of the coach and took the whip then out of the hands of the Norwegians and told them to stand back. He then talked to the oxen in a tongue which was not understood by the Norwegians. It was not even English, but the oxen instantly understood and responded to him, and much to the surprise of the Norwegians, pulled the wagon out of the mud. They wondered who was this man with his power over animals. Well, he was to be the next prophet of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, a man whose name would be known for generations to come. Now, the death of Joseph and Hiram was very difficult for everyone, and history records that this was true especially for Joseph's mother, and there was more sorrow to come. Lucy wrote in her book that she was pondering on the calamities which had befallen her family when suddenly her son Samuel entered the room and said, "Mother, I have had a dreadful distress in my side ever since I was chased by the mud, and I think I have received some injury which is going to make me sick." Well, Lucy says it wasn't long until he couldn't sit up. He lingered until the 13th of July, 1844, and then he died at 33 days after his brothers had been killed. Well, Samuel was 36 years old. This was Lucy's last living son, William, was on a mission to the eastern states. And since his wife had been ill with a dropsy, he had taken his family with him, hoping that the journey might be a benefit to her. But now that she, too, was at the point of death, he couldn't make the trip back, and so Lucy felt she had no member of her family there to speak one consoling word to her in this very trying hour. Well, Lucy had raised six sons to manhood, and only one now remained. It wasn't until the spring of 1845 that William was able to bring his wife to Nauvoo, but she survived only 2 weeks after her arrival, and thus Lucy said, quote, "Her death, caused as it was by her exposures in Missouri, brought the sum of martyrs in her family to no less than six in number," unquote. Well, the church at this time was in a state of gloomy suspense. Lucy says that the saints weren't sure who would take the place of Joseph, and so they were quite anxious, lest an imposter should arise and deceive many. Well, it was at this time that Sidney Rigdon made his appearance from Pittsburgh and implied that the church ought to choose him, not as president, but as guardian, for, he said, Joseph is still president and the church must be built up unto him. But before he could follow through with his recommendations, the 12, who had also been absent, arrived and assumed their proper places, and things began to right themselves. Sidney was wrong. The church belonged to Jesus Christ, not Joseph. And the keys of authority and leadership had already been bestowed upon men who would direct the church in the continued building up of his kingdom. Well, it seems that Sidney was not the only one struggling with the ideas as to who should lead the church. So was Emma. Now that the death and burial were behind her, her thoughts began to be concerned with many things, and the most prevalent in her mind at this moment were her financial problems. With him gone, she was now the head of her house, and so, when William Clayton called to see Emma to offer his condolences, he found her very upset. She had a conversation with Lucy, Joseph's mother, over her finances, and some concerns came up in regard to the property that had been in the prophet's name. The men had been judiciously trying to get matters resolved as quickly as possible, so that the necessary needed changes could take place in an orderly manner. No doubt Emma was beginning to feel a little displaced. Having lost so much in her life, it seems reasonable to assume that Emma wanted to know her status and the status of her finances. I don't believe that she had any intention of moving west, or anywhere else for that matter, for in her mind Joseph was still here. The mansion house was her home, the home she and Joseph had shared. She decorated it, raised her children in it, entertained guests, and she was emotionally attached to it. Also, Joseph, her beloved, was buried nearby. Dead, maybe, but nevertheless close by. In her mind, there was no life for her elsewhere, and so now we see how she begins to obsessively make her claims upon what she perceived as her properties. Properties which would not only assure her of some security and comfort, but would also make her a very rich woman. However, in truth, not all these properties were hers, and she would do this at the expense of the saints. Without Joseph, she probably felt there was no organized church, or perhaps she had ideas that her sons would replace Joseph one day by making claim to the properties, protect them for his sons, and secure their position, even if it meant difficulties. Thus, Emma became wary, and though a temporary trustee was appointed by the remaining church leaders, Emma let it be known she wanted a say as to who he might be. She gave them an ultimatum that either the men meet her approval or she would cause problems. Well, her tirades with Joseph over polygamy were probably very well known amongst the saints, and her behavior now did not engender friendship or good workable relationships. And probably being a bit paranoid, whatever degree of loyalty Emma might have felt for them under different circumstances was now replaced with animosity. Now remember, it was natural for Emma to become involved in her own business affairs because Joseph was ahead of his time and allowed her to do so on numerous occasions. Also, because he was gone so much, she had to do this in his stead. However, in that day and time, the other men were not used to women handling business affairs, and they wanted to keep everything very private, especially now when the mobs were ready to use any excuse to disrupt the affairs of the church. Well, the men often excluded her, even when the affairs discussed would concern her, and she flared in anger, accusing them, saying that these type of secret meetings had cost Joseph and Hiram their lives. Emma did not even trust William Clayton, even though he had been Joseph's scribe, personal secretary, confidant, and constant companion. She became indignant and difficult. Why should he be in charge of Joseph's affairs instead of her? She was very territorial. Her distrust of William Clayton most likely was based on some jealousy over the time that Joseph had spent with the man, and now, under stress, her animosity and bitterness surfaced. She had been the prophet's wife, a leader in her own right. Who were these men to tell her what to do? Joseph had always been the go-between for Emma, and some of these men, now that he was no longer there to temper things, found it difficult to deal with her. Well, it appears by her actions that she no longer cared about the church and its welfare, and she lost the loyalty that she should have had toward it and God. Now, last week, we read her sorrowful comments on how she thought the Lord had abandoned her in allowing Joseph to die, and she may have been angry with him. Sometimes people blame God when they lose a loved one and turn away. Emma seems to be a classic case. Since it had been only 8 days since Joseph and Hiram's deaths, nerves were frayed and emotions were disturbed and erratic. Well, when Joseph Coolidge came back to Emma and offered her what was considered an honorable settlement, consisting of her household goods, the old homestead house, two horses, two cows, her spinning wheels, and $124 a year for the support of the family. She took it as an affront. This was paltry to her. She was living in a mansion. It was actually generous for that day and time for a woman in her position, but in her mind she was moving from a mansion to a homestead house. She'd come so far and now I was lost. Well, emotionally she had not yet accepted the fact that with the death of Joseph everything was different. However, later she did move out of the mansion house to appease the men for a time. Thus it appears she fully understood that it belonged to the church and not to her. But later, with sophisticated calculation on her part, her good intentions proved to be but temporary. So often in the past, we have studied where Emma would bow to the wishes of the Lord for a time and be very humble and then later regret it and cause an uproar. She seemed to constantly be at war with herself when it came to territorial issues. Well, according to her history, it's most likely that Emma told these men what she considered a fair patrimony. Well, since most of these men probably didn't understand the extent of Emma's business sense and involvement in Joseph's and her affairs, they really didn't take her seriously. But she was not a woman to be ignored. She stubbornly desired to make claim on those properties and goods which she considered were hers as the widow of Joseph Smith. Now, after reading the history of the church, I can't help but draw the conclusion that these men already knew that they didn't have long in the area and wanted to sell off all the properties for the move west. At first, I don't think they realized that Emma would become such a thorn in the flesh and did not have this same goal. And Emma, for reasons known only to herself, not only took legal action to retain properties she thought were rightly hers, but she also pushed ahead in a relentless manner against church leaders for a clear title to all church holdings. She either completely ignored or didn't understand the fact that the brethren had made a decision in 1843 that the town needed more lodging space as a hotel and investment property, and regardless of the fact that it was also to be a stately home for its prophet leader, the mansion house had been built using church monies and belonged to the church. But to Emma, it was her domain. She and Joseph entertained dignitaries and hosts of people in this home, and she still had status there. Well, having lost Joseph, now Emma was relentlessly clinging to anything and everything that had been a part of their lives together. I believe she probably felt she couldn't lose one more thing. Well, it's hard for us in our day to fully understand why, as the wife of the prophet and president of the Relief Society, she had appeared to have lost her testimony. But we have to be careful not to judge her too harshly. She'd seen so much. She'd experienced so many trials, so many losses. Parents, children, family, friends, Joseph, reputation, and now her home. So much pain. In her mind, she no longer had a man to protect her, and she still had children to raise. She had made some enemies. Emotionally, I think that with the death of Joseph, she was almost broken and quite fearful of the future. But obviously, she was a strong woman, and no doubt she felt that without exhibiting great resolve, as she would have done in the past, all these different stressful situations, that she probably wouldn't survive. You know, in spite of her pregnancy, she now continued pushing forward relentlessly with determination to pursue that which she had resolved as was necessary to preserve her way of life. Well, unfortunately, though, without the church in her life, the vision of the future for her was grim, and her decisions and her visions became clouded. She lost her perspective. Having resisted what she considered the more radical additions to church doctrine, even when Joseph was alive, she was not about to have them thrust upon her after his death. There were already breakaway groups who were keeping certain tenets of the faith that they believed to be true and discarding the rest. One of those was the reorganized church. And Sidney Rigdon pulled away many of the English saints who left with him for Pittsburgh, also bolting from the church. Well, since there had never been a transfer of authority before, there were strained relationships on all sides. Even the leaders had questions. Thus, it was significant that on one particular day, Brigham was pondering whether Joseph had taken the keys of the kingdom with him from the earth. But after a moment's reflection, he brought his hand down on his knee and with a burst of inspiration exclaimed, "The keys of the kingdom are right here with the church." Well, of course they were. Joseph had been very responsible. He made sure that they were conferred upon the apostles these keys before his death. Okay, let's back up here just a little bit. We know that by August 6, 1844, all the apostles were back in Nauvoo. The saints all thought it was very providential for the 12 to arrive at this particular junction. Shortly thereafter, at a meeting, Sidney Rigdon spoke for 1.5 hours, attempting to convince the saints that he should lead the church. And he continued to lay out his pretentious claims, saying that he had a vision, which the Lord had showed him concerning the situation of the church, and said he was the guardian angel that the ancient prophets had sung about, wrote, and rejoiced over, and he was sent to do the work of the prophets. Now, there was some truth in the second part of this, for remember, he was indeed a spokesman for Joseph, just as Aaron was for Moses, but that did not entitle him to the position of a prophet. At another meeting held later in the day, Brigham Young spoke, explaining that Joseph Smith had conferred upon the 12 the keys necessary to lead the church. And Brigham, in his booming voice, countered Sidney, saying, "Do we want a guardian or a prophet?" Sidney pressed on, saying that he was Joseph's counselor and Joseph's spokesman, whether in life or in death. And Brigham retorted, "In that case, if you are to be Joseph's spokesman, then you need to go where Joseph is now, beyond the veil." Well, not to be outdone, Sidney said he had power and authority from above the 12 and did not consider himself amenable to their counsel. And he said that in his opinion, the church had not been led by the Lord for a long time. Boy, Sidney was puffed up in pride, wasn't he? Well, many people in the congregation later testified that as President Brigham spoke, he was miraculously transfigured so that he seemed to have the voice and the appearance of the prophet Joseph. Now, this was the sign they needed to throw their support behind Brigham. And so on August 8, 1844, the saints voted to sustain Brigham Young and the 12 apostles as leaders of the church. That came from the History of Joseph Smith by his mother, page 467. You can also get it in the Comprehensive History of the Church, volume 2, page 418. But Brigham had all he could handle to now stem the tide of discontent among the anti-polygamy factions. We all know where Emma stood on polygamy. She hated it. Now, as we discussed earlier, she was now widowed, frightened, and a little belligerent, and she was also approaching the last stages of her pregnancy and was certainly concerned about the loss of a wage earner. Now, as a result, her son, Joseph III, described the unfortunate state of affairs between Emma and the brethren in the church when he stated that she was obnoxious to Brigham Young and others. Well, when Dr. Willard Richards, a good friend of hers, visited Emma, he asked her to turn over to the church the new translation of the Bible, which Joseph had completed. Now, it needed to be in the hands of the newly appointed leaders of the church, but she declined to give it to them. Historians conjectured that perhaps since she had carried it with Joseph's changes scribbled in the margins out of Missouri under the folds of her skirt, she felt it was her personal property. Well, at any rate, she agreed to turn it over to the brethren if they would give her a deed to the Cleveland farm. But when they did, she still withheld the new translation, saying it would be forthcoming. There were indeed some difficult problems between Brigham and Emma. Both were strong-willed and headstrong. Both were leaders in their own right. According to her son, Emma saw Brigham as a man inclined to dominate and make everything and everybody bend to his will. No doubt Brigham saw her in the same light. She refused to give her stamp of approval to the things that he was doing, and she was a source of annoyance to Brigham. It was a real power struggle. Then, in the midst of her trial, she gave birth to her last child, a little boy named David Hiram Smith. This gave her some comfort, but big changes were in the making. By the winter of 1845 through 46, the main body of the church was steadily preparing to go west. Once again, they feared the mobs, for they were again determined to rid the territory of Mormons, and the situation was getting tense. So Brigham sent some of the saints to help Emma prepare to move, but she flatly refused. She had already decided not to go west with the Latter-day Saints. Well, Brigham was very deeply concerned because in spite of her tempestuous disposition, as the widow of the prophet, Emma and her children would be a target for the mob, and thus he was concerned with their safety. He also knew that the situation would deteriorate even more once the church leadership departed. And with Emma's belligerent attitude, Brigham was concerned that she would drift further away from the church and carry with her the prophet's children, which is precisely what she did. Already the mob had begun attacking the outlying Mormon towns, and so preparations were speeded up to leave the state. Remember, even the law was against them. Governor Ford demanded by way of resolution that the Mormons get out once and for all. There was no protection from plundering or physical harm. Even though Emma remained aloof, there were those who never stopped trying to convince her to go west with them. But she refused to reconsider her position, especially when she heard that Brigham had married several of Joseph's wives in polygamy after Joseph's death in an effort to protect them. And Emma was determined not to be one of them. She did not want or desire his protection. Finally, as a last goodwill effort, several of the brethren went together one last time to Emma to encourage her to change her mind and go with them. And finally, she gave them a condition that she would go if she could be the leading spirit. In other words, their leader. She would take Joseph's place. After all, she'd been the president of Relief Society, and Joseph had often counseled with her, and upon occasion had often followed her counsel when it was reasonable. Well, in spite of their differences of opinion, he always showed her great respect. But upon the death of Joseph, the organizations no longer functioned, and everyone had been released from these callings. The women's organization had ceased operations until a better spirit prevailed. She must have felt her leadership talents were equal to those of any of the current constituted leaders. One historian records that at one point she even demanded that Joseph sustain her instead of Brigham and Heber and the rest of the 12 apostles of God, but he refused. I don't believe Emma had a clear understanding of the priesthood and the role of men. Obviously, she felt she had witnessed what she believed was incompetency and felt that she was superior. We have women who feel that way today. But nevertheless, God in his wisdom has given men and women differing roles which balance one another, and the priesthood is not given to women. You know, I don't contend to know what really happened to Emma emotionally or psychologically, but I think we have to acknowledge, as before, the constant stress that she was under and the strain, the difficult trials, the tribulations, again, the death of her children, the perpetual running and lack of stability, the continuous shock of beatings, rapes, murders, and other horrors, lack of finances, the fear of armies and marauders, prison. And, of course, Joseph's death all had to have a profound effect upon this woman. Psychologists today could probably have quite a heyday here, attributing all kinds of psychological disorders to her situation, and probably with good cause. I do know that Brigham softened toward her during the last stages of his life, but that was after living with quite a few polygamous wives and having to deal directly with some pretty independent and intelligent women among them. Well, regardless of the reasons, Emma turned on the church. Whether she desired this power so she could assume leadership of the church in a caretaker role until her son reached maturity, or whether she desired it for herself, we'll probably never really know. But we do know that in spite of everything, Brigham tried hard to protect Emma and Joseph's children. He even had an uninterrupted police surveillance around their premises. But rather than appreciate his deep concerns, Emma felt it was a harassment by Brigham. But certainly there was no purpose in that. It was a difficult time because during the final months, while the saints were selling their properties and preparing to move on, no one felt secure in hostile Nauvoo. Not Emma, not her family, not Brigham Young. No one. It seems reasonable that in spite of her rocky emotional status, Brigham was protecting Emma and her family from the many dangerous men around the area. So it does make good sense for him to post men around the premises. There were more days of unrest and mob violence, and the criminal types were now beginning to inch their way into the heart of the city, and now Emma received a threat to leave her home or have it burned to the ground. There was real danger there. Well, 3 days after the last of the Mormons headed west, finally Emma and a few others with her also departed. They boarded a steamer and they moved to Fulton City. Now, to ensure the safety of her property, Emma rented the mansion house out, fully furnished, to a Mr. Van Tool. Her flight was none too soon. Mobs are already seen camped on Hiram's farm as the steamer passed by on its journey to Fulton City. Later, Emma was to return to Nauvoo when it was discovered that Mr. Van Tool had stolen some of the furniture and had secured passage on a steamer. At that point, Emma took possession of the mansion house. She was now a very wealthy woman, as she retained many of the properties once owned by the church around the area, and she later married a man by the name of Bitterman. Now, he was not a religious man, intended to drink. Together, they decided to control even more church properties, and so they met with lawyers to invoke an Illinois law that stated no church could hold more than 10 acres of land in the state. And thus, by quick claim deed, she took control of all the properties belonging to the church. Now, this protected her interests and prevented further financial remuneration to the westward-bound Mormons. Certainly, she was business-minded and extremely intelligent, but ruthless as well. However, she did show some human compassion in taking in Lucy Mack Smith when she became too old to take care of herself. Now, Lucy did not go west because what family she had left was yet alive and had chosen to remain behind. Lucy was Emma's last direct tie to her prophet husband, insofar as what had gone before. And with her death, Emma became more of a recluse. She gradually withdrew from anyone connected with the church. And she refused to admit that Joseph had ever taught or practiced the principle of polygamy in any form, be it physical or spiritual. And she taught her children that there was no such thing as plural marriage during the life of her husband. She stated that the blemish of polygamy was engrafted upon Mormonism, which was a pure, gentle, trusting faith by Brigham Young and Orson Pratt after her husband's cruel assassination. She and her sons joined the reorganized church, and she gifted to them the original manuscript of the prophet's revisions of the Old and New Testaments, called the New Translation, which had already been purchased by Brigham Young and other leaders of the church. Originally, I believe she saw this as an opportunity to use her influence for herself or her sons, but she drifted away from this church as well. So then, does that mean that Emma lost everything? Well, there's always hope for everyone, and I found something in Lucy Mack Smith's book called History of Joseph Smith by His Mother, page 451, which gives us some hope for Emma. Quote, a few days before Emma's death, nearly 35 years after the martyrdom, she told her nurse Elizabeth Revel that Joseph had come to her in a vision and said, Emma, come with me. It's time for you to come with me. As Emma related it, she said, I put on my bonnet and my shawl and I went with him. I did not think that it was anything unusual. I went with him into a mansion and he showed me through the different apartments of the beautiful mansion. And one room was the nursery, and in that nursery was a babe in the cradle. She said, I knew my babe, my Don Carlos, that was taken from me. She sprang forward, caught the child up in her arms, and wept with joy over the child. When Emma recovered sufficiently, she turned to Joseph and said, Joseph, where are the rest of my children? Then she saw, standing by his side, a personage of light, even the Lord Jesus Christ. Unquote. Well, you know, it says in the New Testament, in my house there are many mansions. If it were not so, I would not have told you so. I go to prepare a place for you. Exactly where Emma went, to what kingdom of glory, we're not told. But according to this dream, it appears she was happy. Only the Lord knew the intent of her heart. Well, we'll leave judgment to him. Okay, we're at a halfway point, so stay with me while I take a quick break. Welcome back, everyone, to the second half of our Gospel Doctrine Enrichment Program. I'm Donna Max. In this last half hour, we learned that because of the bombs and lack of protection from the government, the church now moved west. Emma stayed behind, remarried, took possession of all the church properties, and gradually fell completely away from the church, any church. Now, as for the main body of the church who were now on the move, when word got out that the Mormons were in mass exodus, many new settlers came from all over the United States who were attracted there by the low price of property. And they knew but little of previous difficulties or the merits of the quarrel. They saw for their own eyes, I should say here, that the Mormons were industriously preparing to go away. And they knew of their own knowledge that the effort to expel them with force was unnecessarily cruel. Some of the Mormons who hadn't been able to sell their properties or who had lingered behind for one reason or another were now hunted and beaten, regardless of sex or age. Seeing the injustice perpetrated against the Mormons, some of these new settlers stood by the saints, side by side, to protect the beautiful city of Nauvoo from what appeared to them as marauders and lawless mobs. And many of them were expelled by the mobs from the city right along with the Mormons. History records that some of them were simply protecting the property that they had bought from the Mormons. In addition to the atrocities perpetrated upon the new citizens of the city of Nauvoo, as well as the Mormons, the mob took possession of the beautiful temple and desecrated it by their drunken revels. It was here they made their headquarters and passed their sentence of banishment upon many of its citizens. Well, in the History of the Church, Volume 3, it says, and I'll edit, in the early part of 1846, the main body of saints had now already been forced to sell their farms. Most of them had to take whatever they could get. Some even exchanged their valuable property for simply a wagon and livestock. The lawless mobs had become so corrupt that there were none to defend and maintain the sacredness of the law. Thus, the saints began a mass exodus as early as the 4th of February. The first encampment after leaving the west bank of the Mississippi was on Sugar Creek in Iowa Territory, about 9 miles from Nauvoo. The cold, attended by severe snowstorms, became intense and remained so for many days. And while this facilitated the exodus by enabling many to cross the river on the ice, it caused great suffering in the camps. On the first night of the encampment, Eliza R. Snow wrote that, quote, 9 children were born into the world, and from that time, mothers gave birth to offspring under almost every variety of circumstances imaginable, except to those to which they had been accustomed, sometimes in tents, others in wagons, in rainstorms, in snowstorms, whatever. One birth occurred under the rude shelter of a hut, the sides of which were formed of blankets fastened to poles stuck in the ground, with a bark roof through which the rain was dripping. Kind sisters stood holding dishes to catch the water as it fell, thus protecting the newcomer and its mother from a shower bath as the little infant first entered on the stage of human life. And through faith in the great ruler of events, no harm resulted to either. Let it be remembered that these mothers of the wilderness born babies were not savages, accustomed to roam the forest and brave the storm and tempest. They came from lovely homes decorated with flowers and enriched with choice fruit trees just beginning to yield plentifully. To these homes, without lease or sale, they had just bid a final adieu, and with what little of the substance that could be packed into 1, 2, or in some instances 3 wagons, had started out desert-ward for where? To this question, the only response at that time was, God knows, unquote. Well, there was some confusion exhibited among the saints because at this point the camp had not yet received that efficient organization which would characterize them later. The camps were passing through a new and for the most part a sparsely settled country. Money and labor and household furnishings among those settlers were scarce. The saints here and there had a little money among them, but they were going where it would not be of much value. They had household furnishings, indispensable as they thought upon leaving Nauvoo, but which the simplicity of their camp life taught them they could do without. These money and household goods were readily exchanged for food supplies and cattle to strengthen their teams. They were rich in labor power, and the country on both sides of their line of travel was scoured for work that could be done by contract, and not too much delay their westerly movement. Well, such labor as husking corn, splitting rails, and fencing fields, clearing farms, building houses, and so forth. Their journey through southern Iowa was a fortunate circumstance for the settlers in those parts. It gave an impetus to the development of their farms and towns. These Mormon exiles from their city beautiful and their homes asked for no gratuities. Their basis of barter with Iowa and Missourian settlers was an even exchange of equal values, and their own pressing necessities often led them to give the settlers the better of the bargain in the exchange. Beautiful items were left behind to enrich the lives of others. Well, once this body of 20,000 armed Mormons began to move, the government of the United States suddenly became concerned. Serious objections were now being made to the departure of the saints from the United States. After all, they conjectured, they could join themselves with either Mexico or Great Britain, as war with both of these nations were then being regarded as imminent, and it was not an unreasonable supposition, on general principles, that the serious wrongs endured by the saints of Missouri and Illinois, and which the general government had chosen not to mitigate or redress, had sapped the fountains of their patriotism. Why, they could be rendered susceptible to British or Mexican influence if only reasonable assurances were given them of immunity from those interferences in the establishment of their church and life in harmony with their ideals, which so far they had vainly sought for in the states of Missouri and Illinois. Imagine that, for goodness sakes. Furthermore, they alleged, it could be said that it was not good policy to allow a people 20,000 strong, armed and with so much cause for resentment as the Latter-day Saints had against the United States, to go into an enemy's country, lest they strengthen that enemy by the addition to him of their fighting force, unquote. Well, however, nothing came of their concerns. For as we know, Brigham pushed ahead to the semi-desert valley of the Great Salt Lake, and they posed no threat to anyone. And we know that when the army requested volunteers from among the Mormons to fight in the Mexican War, that Brigham Young encouraged the saints to enlist to show our patriotism to the United States. Well, this western drive was not Brigham's original idea. Joseph Smith had contemplated very early after the Missouri persecutions the movement of the Mormons to the west. Brigham Young testified to this fact when he said, I did not devise the great scheme of the Lord's opening the way to send his people to these mountains. Joseph Smith contemplated the move for years before it took place, but he could not get here. President Wilford Woodruff quoted Joseph also in these words, quote, I want to say to you before the Lord that you know no more concerning the destinies of this church and kingdom than a babe upon its mother's lap. You don't comprehend it. It's only a little handful of priesthood that you see here tonight. But this church will fill North and South America. It will fill the Rocky Mountains. There will be tens of thousands of Latter-day Saints who will be gathered in the Rocky Mountains. And there they will open the door for the establishment of the gospel among the Lamanites. This people will go into the Rocky Mountains. They will there build temples to the Most High God. They will raise up a posterity there, and the Latter-day Saints who dwell in these mountains will stand in the flesh until the coming of the Son of Man. The Son of Man will come to them while in the Rocky Mountains. Unquote. Well, on February 20, 1844, Joseph instructed the 12 apostles to send out a delegation to investigate California, New Mexico, and Oregon, and other good locations where the saints could move after the temple was completed. He even organized a special council, later to be called the General Council. And part of their duties was to plan and carry out the exodus of the saints to the West to obtain redress for the wrongs which had been inflicted upon them by their persecutors. Some of the members of this council were not members of the church. The council consisted of 50 members. After Joseph was killed, this general council continued in this effort until, under Brigham Young, actually. Okay, let's turn to Section 136. Now, the winter of 1846 and 47 was spent at winter quarters, which today, we're told, is Florence, Nebraska. It was while encamped at winter quarters that President Brigham Young received a revelation from the Lord. Now, here, then, was the only revelation in the Doctrine and Covenants given through a prophet other than Joseph Smith. The revelation was given as a guide to the saints for their organization and their conduct in their great move to the West, because the chief topic of conversation was the march into the wilderness. I'm picking up here with verse 1. In their journeys to the West, the Lord says that all the people of the church and those who journey with them are to be organized into companies with a covenant as they journey towards a new home and promise to keep all the commandments and statutes of the Lord. The companies are to be organized with captains of hundreds, captains of 50s, captains of 10s, with a president and his two counselors at their head, under the direction of the 12 apostles. Sounds like ancient Israel, doesn't it? Well, in regard to that covenant, they're all to keep all the ordinances, decrees, or directions of the Lord. Then these companies were to be organized on the order followed by Zion's camp in their remarkable march from Kirtland to Missouri. And each company was to provide itself with the wagons, teams, provisions, clothing, and other items necessary for the trip. Now, some members of necessity would be left behind until just such time as they could be prepared. Each company was to help prepare for those coming after. The first were the real pioneers and were to put in spring crops and build homes and make ready for the ones who would follow later. None were to fear their enemies, for they would not have power to stop the work of the Lord. As this great body moved west across Iowa, they did indeed establish camps for those who would follow. Under persecution, the saints joined ranks. Land was plentiful and nearly everywhere fertile. Much of it as yet was public land, unsurveyed and not yet on the market. Again, this could be settled upon, and the saints could take advantage of this planting in the spring, and the crops could be left to be harvested by the companies which would come later in the season. Plant that others may harvest, sow that others may reap. This is the lesson of every civilization that's worthwhile. The sacrifice of present comfort for future advantage. The practice of present self-denial for future gain. This is the spirit of this new dispensation of the gospel received by and exemplified in the lives of this modern Israel in its march toward and into a wilderness that as yet had no definite objective point marked off in it, beyond the general idea of a likely settlement in the great basin of the Rocky Mountains as the future home of this marching column of exiles. That was the History of the Church, Volume 3, page 42 through 43. Now, this history also mentions that hardships often occurred because of lack of planning. Now, in one particular case, it says, quote, then too, many who left the city ill prepared for life in the wilderness in midwinter proved to be a burden upon those who had proceeded with better judgment. In one particular case, over 800 men reported to the Sugar Creek encampment during the last 2 weeks of February without more than a fortnight's provisions for themselves and their teams. Those who had used wisdom and carried with them a year's supply of food for themselves and families, had given it all out to their less provident brethren. Well, it was evident from the very start that resources for subsistence for this modern Israel in Exodus must be created as they traveled, and their leaders were equal to the occasion. There was no complaining. With commendable patience, the great leader and dominant spirit of this movement, Brigham Young, took largely upon himself the cares and the trials of his people. When he reproved them, it was never for their being there and in destitute circumstances. For now and always, Brigham Young had stood by the poor. Unquote. Well, the council chose 25 men to be captains of hundreds who were selected, who selected 100 families to see that they were prepared to cross the Rocky Mountains. Now, not all members were prepared to go west, and the officers of the companies were to decide who might go and who would be better to remain behind, as I said earlier, so that they could go at a more suitable time of day. And then verse 8 adds that each company was to bear an equal proportion according to the dividend of their property in taking the poor, the widows, the fatherless, and the families of those who had gone into the army. And this was to be done for the benefit of all. So we see that those who had substance were to share with those who were destitute in the true spirit of charity and faith. There were indeed widows and fatherless among them who needed to depend upon someone. And the saints were told, starting with verse 11, that if they would do this, the Lord would pour out upon them his blessings. They should be blessed in their flocks, their herds, their fields, their houses, and their families. Specific men were then chosen by name to lead out in their respective companies. Well, verse 16 adds that all the saints were to be taught the Lord's will in this so that they could be made ready to go to a land of peace. Now, it's interesting that the council determined the routes to be taken and the previous experiences of the Zion's camp, which no one could have foreseen, proved invaluable in moving the main body of the church. Many of these saints had felt that Nauvoo was the place for the redemption of Zion, and now that realization seemed farther and farther removed. Their faith was sorely tried. They now had to wait on the Lord and travel to some unknown region of the Rocky Mountains. The Lord would lead them as he did the children of Israel, and he was just as mindful of the saints today as he was then. They were to take courage. And the Lord told them, again in verse 17, they were not to fear their enemies, for he, the Lord, had not forgotten Zion. And it should be remembered in due time of the Lord, and those enemies would have no power to stop his work. Thus far, the saints had been prevented from redeeming Zion. They were cruelly persecuted and driven out of Missouri, where the New Jerusalem was to have been built. And now the Lord gives further advice about Zion's redemption in verses 18 through 27. Zion is to be redeemed in the Lord's own due time. And any man who seeks to build up himself at the expense of others and seeks not his, the Lord's counsel, shall have no power, he says, and his folly is to be made manifest. That means he's going to lose his reward. Every man was to respect the rights and the property of the rest, and all should be wise stewards. They were to honor their pledges one to another, not covet something which belonged to another. He specifically told them to keep themselves from evil, not take the Lord's name in vain, for he said in verse 21, I am the Lord your God, even the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham and of Isaac and of Jacob. And he reminds them in verse 22, I am he who led the children of Israel out of the land of Egypt. And he says, my arm is stretched out in the last days to save my people Israel, meaning the saints. Now we've learned in past lessons that when the Lord says his arm is stretched out, that means in great power will he deliver his people Israel. Perhaps here we should compare the differences between the exodus of the early Israelites to the modern Israelites. But first I want to say that the Lord is very specific in verses 23 through 27 as to what he expects of his saints. They're not to argue or contend with one another or speak evil, gossip about each other. If you borrow something, return it. If you break it, go tell the person who loaned it to you so he doesn't get so angry. And then you should diligently strive to restore it. We're also to be diligent stewards over what the Lord has given us, because it's the Lord's. We're simply his stewards. Well, for the comparison of ancient Israel to modern Israel, President Anthony W. Ivins said this, quote, the Israelites were going out from a grievous and humiliating bondage and returning to their old home in the land of their fathers. Modern Israel were leaving their homes, the lands of their fathers, and were going into a country unknown to them, a country inhabited by civilized men. The Israelites were a people of one race, influenced in the accomplishment of their purpose by the traditions and religion of their fathers. The Latter-day Saints were composed of people gathered from various nations, bringing with them different traditions, different customs, different languages. Ancient Israel was separated from their destination by about only 250 miles in a direct line, and that over a country where great armies had marched from remote times. The Mormon pioneers traveled over a road in mountains where few had gone before, a distance of more than 1,000 miles. Ancient Israel were led by great demonstrations of the power of the Lord, like the opening of the Red Sea, and their daily bread was provided by manna sent down from heaven. The Mormon pioneers walked by divine faith and provided for their daily necessities with the labor of their own hands. Reaching their destiny, their destination, ancient Israel found cities already built, orchards and vineyards already planted, and flocks and herds which the Lord delivered into their hands. Modern Israel found a desert waste, which could only be redeemed and made productive by infinite toil. So Anthony Ivan said, "I feel justified in saying that this accomplishment has no parallel in the history of the world." You know, it's interesting that in section 136, verse 28, the Lord instructed the people to sing and dance in spite of their trials. He knew that though they might be weary and discouraged, that the merrymaking would lift their spirits. They were to praise the Lord with singing and music, with dancing and with prayer and thanksgiving. Yes, on occasion they were to turn to light things, but harmless pleasures. But they were counseled to keep the Lord in mind as they did so. Also, the Lord said that if they're sorrowful, he wants them to call on him with supplication so he can make their hearts joyful. Now, keep in mind, there's a difference between merriment and raucous behavior. And remember, no noble soul who has God close at hand can long remain sorrowful. Obedience to this revived their spirits and overcame their despondency and discouragement. Frequently, someone with a violin furnished music for dancing and singing. Again, in this respect, this modern exiled Israel differed somewhat from ancient captive Israel, because the scriptures say that the latter wept when they remembered Zion, and they hanged their harps upon the willows in the midst thereof, and when their captors required of them a song and mirth, saying, "Sing us one of the songs of Zion," the captives made answer, "How shall we sing the Lord's song in a strange land?" And they wept. But not so with this modern exiled Israel. They sang and played and everywhere found favor. They softened the hearts and they changed the sentiments, even of their enemies who looked on in awe. Unquote. Well, this scores heavily on the side of the Latter-day Israel, that they could thus forget all their sorrows and their wrongs and minister to the pleasure of those who at best had little sympathy for them. And while they had much cause to remain aloof from all except those of their own faith, it's to their credit that they were not soured or hardened into social indifference toward their fellow men. The saints had great faith that the then impending and exiled or enforced exile would be but a temporary condition, that the saints would remain Americans in the sense of being loyal to the institution and government of the United States as the dominant power pledged to the main of human freedoms and civic righteousness in this Western Hemisphere. Again, they were not to worry or complain about their enemies. For good or evil, they were in the hands of the Lord. And then in verse 31 through 33, that's section 136, the Lord explains to them, quote, "My people must be tried in all things, that they may be prepared to receive the glory that I have for them, even the glory of Zion, and he that will not bear chastisement is not worthy of my kingdom." You know, earlier during the sojourn in Missouri, the Lord had told them that only after much tribulation come the blessings. And he adds, "He that's ignorant is to learn wisdom by humbling himself and by calling upon God, in order that his eyes may be open to see and his ears open to hear. For the Lord's Spirit is sent into the world to enlighten the humble and contrite and to condemn the ungodly. He wants enlightened followers. He wants them to understand his principles, not misconstrue them. Suffering and trials are essential to the eternal welfare of man. Those who seek a place in the celestial kingdom in exaltation must of necessity be called upon to pass through tribulation." Now, at an earlier day, the Lord had declared that it would be after much tribulations that blessings would come. Section 58, verses 2 through 3 say, "For verily I say unto you, blessed is he that keepeth my commandments, whether in life or in death. And he that is faithful in tribulation, the reward the same is greater in the kingdom of heaven. You cannot behold with your natural eyes, for the present time, the design of your God concerning those things which shall come hereafter, and the glory which shall follow after much tribulation." Well, this is a principle that's been taught throughout the ages. In fact, in the New Testament, Paul says that some of the disciples remained on the earth to endure more tribulation that they might have a better resurrection. So instead of railing against tribulation and trials, we might learn from this that those who suffer most may verily well have a much better resurrection. In some faiths, this principle has been carried to the extreme and misunderstood, especially when we see people whip themselves or cut themselves in an effort to show humility. But he's speaking here of trials brought upon us by others, Peter says that we're not to expect a reward for overcoming trials that we bring upon ourselves. Thus, we're to be diligent, not irresponsible, and consider well our actions before we act. The Lord then ends the revelation with a warning in verses 34 through 36 by emphasizing the fate of the nation that rejects the testimony of the prophets and by exhorting his people to diligence. He says, "Because thy brethren, the people of this country, have rejected the testimony of the elders and have driven them into exile, the day of their calamity comes, even the day of sorrow, like a woman taken in travail. Their sorrow will be great unless they very speedily repent. For they killed the prophets and the messengers that were sent to them, and they have shed innocent blood, which cries from the ground against them." The saints are told in verse 37 not to marvel at these things, for he says we don't understand the workings of God. Then the saints are told that they're not yet pure enough to bear the Lord's glory. But the promise is given that if they're faithful in keeping the Lord's words that have been given his people from the days of Adam, Abraham, Moses, Jesus and his apostles to the days of Joseph Smith, that they might behold it. Well, we know that many people have marveled because of the death of Joseph Smith. He was a prophet of the Lord, yet his enemies were allowed to slay his servant. He states that Joseph did his job. He laid the foundation and was faithful, and that he, the Lord, took him to himself. Joseph is in the celestial kingdom. The Lord says that it was needful that he should seal his testimony with his blood, that he might be honored, honored to die for truth and the gospel, that the wicked might be condemned. We're not to be concerned about Joseph. He's better off than we are. He had given the keys for the gifts and blessings of God unto the people, and then his labor was done. He was exhausted. How wonderful. Really quickly, Brigham Young says the United States has been vexed because of its persecution of the Latter-day Saints, and soon thereafter followed the war with Mexico, in which those regiments that were selected from Western Illinois, one of them at least, was well nigh wiped out of existence, and it was about the only disastrous engagement that we had in that war. Then followed the awful Civil War between 1861 and 1865, which Brigham says, and as I believe, the hand of God severely punished the United States of America. That was Conference Report, October 1922, page 97. And since the Civil War, the United States has been involved in five major wars, the Spanish-American War, World Wars I and II, the Korean and Vietnam Wars, not to mention the wars in the Middle East. Nor has war been the only means of vexation. Depressions, natural disasters, and other calamities have plagued the nation. The prophetic promise is that if the people of this nation do not serve the God of this land, who is Jesus Christ, they will be swept off. As yet there's been no nationwide repentance for past and present sins, and so the Lord continues to vex the people of this nation, seeking to bring them unto repentance. And now the Lord ends the revelation, starting with verse 40 of section 136, saying, "Have I not delivered you from your enemies, only in that I have left a witness of my name? Now therefore hearken, O ye people of my church, and ye elders listen together. You have received my kingdom. Be diligent in keeping all of my commandments, lest judgments come upon you, and your faith fail you, and your enemies triumph over you." Now, these are the Master's words for the present. Think about that. I need to close, so I leave this with you. In the name of Jesus Christ, amen. I'm Donna Manns. To